2021 when they killed 1,145 people. 2022's total of 1,176 is the highest annual tally since the nonprofit group began tracking such statistics in 2013. There were only 12 days without a single police killing last year. Officers killed an average of more than three people every day, the statistics show. 132 of these killings involved victims who hadn't been suspected of a crime, and 98 fatal encounters began as traffic stops. Some 24% of those killed were Black, despite Black people making up only 13% of the U.S. population. The violent crime rate in the U.S. has more than halved since 1993. However, violent offenses rose dramatically in some cities in the aftermath of 2020 Black Lives Matter protests, and officers have argued that liberal criminal justice reforms enacted after the police murder of George Floyd that year are costing them their lives. Also, Guardian reported law enforcement in the U.S. killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the U.S. since experts first started tracking the killings and new data analysis has revealed. Police across the U.S. killed an average of more than three people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year, according to Mapping Police Violence. The nonprofit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot, beaten, restrained, and tasered. The preliminary 2022 total, a possible undercount as more cases are cataloged, marks 31 additional fatalities than the year before. In 2021, police killed 1,145 people, 1,152 in 2020, 1,097 in 2019, 1,140 in 2018, and 1,089 in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013 when advocates began counting these fatal incidents. A database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd sparked national uprisings calling for racial justice, police accountability, and reductions in the funding and the size of police forces. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement, an uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings? What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, 11% were cases in which no offense was alleged. 104 cases, 9% were mental health or welfare checks. 98, 8% involved traffic violations. And 207, 18% involved other allegations of nonviolent offenses. There were also 93 cases, 8% involving claims of a domestic disturbance, and 128, 11% where a person was allegedly seen with a weapon. Only 370, 31% involved a potentially more serious situation with an alleged violent crime. Samuel Seni Gua, a data scientist and policy analyst who founded Mapping Police Violence and provided 2022 data to The Guardian, said, "These are routine police encounters that escalate to a killing. The reduction in the conversation around police violence does not mean that the issue is going away. What's clear is that it's continuing to get worse and that it's deeply systematic. What's more, in 32% of cases last year, the person was fleeing before they were killed, generally running or driving off, cases in which experts say lethal force is unwarranted and also endangers the public. In June, Ohio police officers fired dozens of rounds at Jalen Walker, who was unarmed and fleeing. A month later, an officer in California exited an unarmed car and immediately fired at Robert Adams as he ran in the opposite direction." The racial disparities have also persisted. Black people were 24% of those killed last year, while making up only 13% of the population. From 2013 to 2022, black residents were three times more likely to be killed by U.S. police than white people. The inequality is particularly severe in some cities, including Minneapolis, where police have killed black residents at a rate 28 times higher than white residents, and Chicago, where the rate was 25 times higher. Mapping Police Violence reported, "Police ability to be judge, jury, and executioner has been taken to another level. No matter how much we insist that it's wrong, society allows it to take place," said Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was shot by the Kenosha police and left paralyzed in 2020. Blake Sr. and Austin run a group called Families United that assists people whose loved ones have been killed by U.S. police. He also found that there had been a notable uptick in killings by sheriff's departments, which are generally county agencies run by an elected leader. In 2022, sheriffs were involved in 416 killings, higher than the share in 2013, which was 277 cases. It's unclear what's driving that increase, though experts say there had been growing partnerships between sheriffs and other agencies, with deputies executing search warrants or doing chases that can result in death. Sheriff's offices are also particularly politicized during elections, which could contribute to the problem. He said there are campaigns in which there is a race to the bottom to compete to be more tough on crime, and the result is more violent sheriff's departments.
A museum to wonder and reflect, a prison for torture and control, and a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other, but it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. In this week's documentary, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time, the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Qasr edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after more than decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
...1979, Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the gas prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the gas prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass prison. Over the last two centuries, the building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Ghasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
Tehrani che ma emruz ba in gostare va azamat shahedon hastim.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurram Abad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the US ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fath Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasruddin Shah, the palace fell from grace and, abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of three rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the Ghass prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined, an idiom with a pleasant literal meaning but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalised the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balanced intrinsic development in Iranian society.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in SAVAK, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband." Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Davood As-Saadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Saadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
As sole 50 regime Shah برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way.
ولی از سال 50 به بعد در واقع با
But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
Mm-hmm.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن حوصله‌شون سر رفته بود.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad, and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused, and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Sporting achievements after the Islamic Revolution. The Islamic Revolution has had considerable achievements in many fields, including in sports. In this program, we examine Iran's progress in sports after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Please stay with us. More sporting facilities, more athletes, more sportsmen and sportswomen, and winning more medals in international sporting events, including the Olympic Games, are just some of the examples of progress made in Iranian sports in recent years. In the years which followed the Islamic Revolution, young Iranians and sportsmen and sportswomen played a very valuable role in the advancement and development of the country. There is absolutely no doubt that building better sporting facilities and better sporting infrastructure has helped talented young Iranians to thrive in sports and win an assortment of medals in international sporting tournaments, including the Olympic Games. And of course, this is a huge achievement for Iranian sports. Iranian athletes, sportsmen and sportswomen have emerged with flying colours in major sporting tournaments and competitions, such as the Olympic Games, the Volleyball World Championships, the World Wrestling Championships, the World Chess Championships, etc., winning an assortment of titles and medals. Compared to pre-Islamic Revolution days, the number of medals won by Iranian sportsmen and sportswomen in major sporting events has increased several-fold, and this, of course, is a tremendous achievement. Before the Islamic Revolution, less than 20 roofed sporting halls and gymnasiums with a capacity of 2,000 or more existed in Iran. However, today, more than 300 sporting halls and gymnasiums with a capacity to seat 2,000 to 3,000 people have been built in the country. In addition, numerous Olympic-sized swimming pools, football fields, downhill ski trails or pistes, multi-purpose sporting halls, and many sporting complexes have been built in the years after the Islamic Revolution. This has been a huge shot in the arm for Iranian sports, and talented young Iranian sportsmen and sportswomen have flourished throughout the land. It is interesting to note that before the Islamic Revolution, there were about 30 sporting disciplines which could be pursued professionally in Iran. But today, with all the investments made in sporting facilities and sporting infrastructure post-Islamic Revolution, this number has increased to over 170 sporting disciplines. Another interesting fact and figure is that before the revolution, the total sports space per capita was just 3 centimeters in Iran, compared to over a meter of sports space per person post-Islamic Revolution. Iran's world ranking in sports has also improved markedly after the Islamic Revolution. Today, in some sporting disciplines such as indoor soccer or beach football, men's volleyball, wheelchair basketball, also known as Paralympic basketball, women's sitting volleyball, and futsal, Iran's national team is ranked within the top 10 of the world. After the Islamic Revolution, Iran's national football team has managed to qualify for the FIFA World Cup on at least 5 occasions, and today, according to the latest FIFA World Rankings, Iran's national football team is ranked 24th in the world and is also ranked 2nd in Asia. In individual sports, Iran's world ranking is even more impressive. In disciplines such as weightlifting, freestyle wrestling, Greco-Roman wrestling, judo, taekwondo, and wushu, Iran is considered one of the strongest competitors in the world, and Iran's national team is ranked in the top 3 of the world. The Islamic Republic of Iran is also ranked 4th in the world in men's fencing, and is ranked 10th in the world in men's archery, particularly compound events. In women's archery, Iran is ranked 17th in the world. In chess, Iran is currently ranked 28th in the world, according to the International Chess Federation, FIDE. Another important point is the strong presence of Iranian sportswomen in major tournaments and competitions throughout the world. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made huge strides in women's sports. Before the Islamic Revolution, only 9 female head coaches and 7 women umpires were present in Iran. But today, this figure has increased markedly. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we now have literally tens of thousands of women head coaches and women umpires and referees in the country. Before the Islamic Revolution, women were only active in 7 sporting disciplines, but today, women are active in over 40 sporting disciplines in the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is a huge achievement for Iranian sportswomen. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution statement addressed to the Iranian nation on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The Islamic revolution of the Iranian nation has been mighty, but merciful, forgiving, and even oppressed. It has not committed any of the extremist and deviated acts that have marked many other uprisings and movements with stigma. In no conflicts, not even against the United States and Saddam Hussein, did it ever shoot the first bullet, and in all cases it defended itself after the enemy's attack. Of course, it blew the defensive strike vigorously. Since its inception, this revolution has never been merciless, nor has it ever shed blood. It has neither been passive nor hesitant. Standing assertively and courageously against bullies and thugs, it has defended the oppressed. This revolutionary bravery and gallantry, this honesty, assertiveness, and sovereignty This global and regional realm of action in support of the oppressed of the world represent a source of pride for Iran and the Iranians, as may it persist eternally.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, at the beginning of a new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic, I would like to address my dear young people, the generation who steps up to start another part of the great jihad, selfless endeavor for building a great Islamic Iran. The first section of my address concerns the past. Dear ones, you cannot learn but from your own experience or listening to the experiences of others. Many of what we have seen and experimented, your generation has not experienced and seen yet. We have seen and you will see. The decades ahead are your decades, and it is you who should protect your revolution while you are qualified and full of motivation and move it closer to its great ideal. That is, the emergence of a new Islamic civilization and the preparation for the rising of the great son of Velaya. May our souls be sacrificed for him, Imam al-Mahdi ajalallah. To take steady steps in the future, we need to develop a good knowledge of the past and learn from experiences. If this strategy is neglected, lies will replace the truth. And the future will be menaced by the unknown threats.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done. You've done.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
In a first-of-its-kind organ transplant from a dead donor, Iranian surgeons have managed to accomplish an extraordinary feat, saving the lives of several patients, according to a cardiovascular surgeon. ProCivis website has provided an exclusive article in this regard. Stay tuned for more. In an exclusive interview with the ProCivis website, Dr. Sam Zeraatian Nejad Davani said through a novel technique performed for the first time in Iran, organs were donated from a deceased person to living persons. The surgical procedure has so far been performed on three donors, and all the recipients are healthy. Dr. Davani, assistant professor of cardiovascular surgery at Iran University of Medical Sciences, said. However, the results of the transplant have not been officially published in any journal yet. We are waiting to see how recipients' bodies respond to it and how the organ function, he added. The first transplant after an individual's death was carried out 7 months ago, Dr. Davani informed, adding that the CPR, or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, continued for about 60 minutes, but eventually proved unsuccessful. Soon afterward, another patient on the organ transplant waiting list, who matched the donor, was transferred to the operation theater. The doctor remarked the second attempt was a success. He told the ProCivis website, "We successfully managed to transplant a kidney from the completely dead donor to a recipient in the first surgery of its kind." Dr. Davani went on to add that the same scenario played out for the second patient. However, this time, the donor's two kidneys and liver were donated to the matching recipients. In the third patient, the lungs, liver, two kidneys, and pancreas were all donated, he said, noting that the recipients are all doing well and are in a very good condition. Following correspondence with Donation and Transplantation Institute, DTI Foundation, we were assured that this is the first time such a procedure in organ transplant has been performed in the world, Dr. Davani said, adding, "We conducted research for a year before implementing this technique to decide if it proves viable." Pertinently, DTI brings together medical practitioners from Spain, Europe, and America to advise and support the implementation of projects in organ, tissue, and cell donation. Dr. Davani stressed that one of the important factors in implementing the technique is that the team performing it must be on their toes around the clock, as they don't know when a donor may be available. Organ donation is a life-saving procedure, which, according to Dr. Davani, is traditionally performed in the world either after a brain or cardiac death. Brain death is an irreversible condition when all brain activity ceases, and therefore the patient cannot regain consciousness or is able to breathe without critical support. A person who is brain dead is legally confirmed diseased, so the organs may be viable for transplant. On the other hand, some may die due to a cardiac stroke, which results from the abrupt loss of heart function, breathing, and consciousness. This condition usually results from a problem with the heart's electrical system, which disrupts the pumping action and stops blood flow to the body. If not treated immediately, it can potentially lead to death. Donation after cardiac death or non-heart beating organ donation, which is also referred to as donation after circulatory death or DCD, is the retrieval of organs for the purpose of transplantation from patients whose death is diagnosed and confirmed using cardiorespiratory criteria. According to Dr. Davani, donation after cardiac death was performed for the first time in the country by his team at Hazrat Rasul General Hospital, which is affiliated with Iran University of Medical Sciences, a premier medical college and hospital. In donation after cardiac death, doctors perform organ-preserving cardiopulmonary resuscitation, OPCPR, which is defined as the use of CPR in cases of cardiac arrest to preserve organs for transplantation, rather than to revive the patient, he said. After the donor's heart starts to beat again, the patient is transferred to the operating theater, and some drugs to increase the patient's blood pressure are administered, and the process of donating organs in accordance with Health Ministry's guidelines begins, said the surgeon. The technique, Dr. Davani hastened to add, is so far performed in the US, Australia, Spain, as well as Iran. Despite the two aforesaid techniques in donation after complete death, the patient has no blood circulation, heartbeat, or lung function, he remarked. However, there is no difference between the outcome of each of the transplant techniques, the working of the grafts, and the organs function. All the organs are retrievable in donation after complete death, and it solely depends on the alacrity and experience of the surgical team to harvest as many organs as possible, Dr. Davani stated. Dr. Davani said the new technique, as well as donation after cardiac death, will increase the number of available organs by 20 to 30% for patients on the waiting list whose lives hang on a thread. In the post-COVID-19 era, and with a drop in the number of brain deaths due to decreased road mishaps, this strategy will increase the number of possible donors for the recipients on the waiting list. This is a new window and a new era for the future of organ transplantation in our country, the surgeon said. Many patients die in hospitals daily, so the cause of death does not usually matter, he said, adding that they just need to be there at the right time and manner and based on protocols and contraindications. However, the doctor added, it is best to choose patients who die at the hospital and are in the vicinity of an operating theater. Dr. Davani stressed this way donors can be transferred to the operation room as soon as the relatives sign the consent forms. While this technique of donation after complete death has so far been performed at Tehran's Hazrat Rasul General Hospital, Davani said it is possible to use this procedure in all provinces across Iran. He added, surgical teams in other provinces just need to familiarize themselves with the technique as well as learn how to persuade the donors' families to donate their patients' organs. He said that talks are underway with the Ministry of Health to expand the program to other provinces and hospitals in the capital, Tehran, saying, "We already have the necessary infrastructure and technology in order to perform such a procedure in other hospitals, at least in the capital."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About seven decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry, as it would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahwaz.
In line with a fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Services TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel.